This is Teachers Talk Radio, and we are listening live.
Follow the hashtag TT Radio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
And good afternoon to everyone that's out there. You're listening to The Drive Home Show with me, Neil Mullen. And today we've got a little bit of a sensory special, really. So today's show is going to be all things sensory. And we've got a fab guest lined up for us today. Yeah, we're basically going to cover all things sensory, really. So my guest today is Joanna Grace, who is a multi-published author all around sensory. So she's written books on sensory stories, sensory being for sensory beings, and has also written books on other topics, such as the soul spectrum, so working with autistic people. She's also a trainer at the Sensory Projects. She's got her own online courses and is also a TED speaker. So it's massively pleasing that Joanna's joined us today to discuss things all things sensory. So hopefully today we're going to try and cram in as much as we possibly can. If you've got any questions or you'd like to join the discussion, then please do text in and get involved. It would be lovely to hear other people's thoughts as well. So fingers crossed you are there, Joanna.
Yes, I hope so.
Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear. That's fantastic. Lovely to have you on the show. And hopefully I've done you some justice with that little introduction as well. I'm pretty much going to take the back seat here because you are by far and away the expert on sensory and sensory engagement, sensory stories. So for the listeners out there that don't quite know, could you just give us a bit of background on what a sensory story is? Because that's the first real topic that we're going to cover.
Okay, you have to be very careful giving me free rein, Neil, because I could talk about these things all day long. Sensory stories have been a hidden gem in the world of special education for decades, and they're just beginning, or maybe not just beginning, they get around a bit more nowadays, but they're still very much a special education resource, and they shouldn't be, because they're just marvelous. You asked me what they are. They are concise narratives which partner text with rich, relevant sensory experiences. So if you were thinking of them from an artistic point of view, you'd probably think of them as being akin to writing haiku, because you have to condense things down into this sort of pure form. But then you're not just writing with words, you're writing with sounds and smells and tastes and textures as well. And so although you only have, I think the rule of thumb is 8 to 10 sentences to tell your story. Although you've only got 8 to 10 sentences, when you think about that phrase, a picture speaks 1,000 words, if you've got visuals and smells and taste, you know, you've got thousands and thousands of words worth of content within that condensed form. So they're a wonderful thing.
Okay, so I've obviously, my background's in working with special educational needs, and it does tend to be a widely used resource with a wide range of needs, really, sensory stories. But you mentioned there about the value of it should be used on the mainstream side of things. So could you just elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've told them in some universities on film studies courses just to get people thinking about their audience, and just telling them straight to, you know, perfectly cognitively able people got a great response. I think they're just, it's just a bit more interesting, isn't it, than a regular story. But I've used them in mainstream primary settings as a spur for creative writing, encouraging children not just to write about what things look like in their descriptions, but what they sound like and what they feel like. And you get a much more visceral writing quality from children who've experienced a sensory story before being asked to write their own story. And I've used them in secondary school settings. I got invited once to come into a secondary school to work with some GCSE English students. And the teacher who invited me, she said, "We've got two bottom set English, Joe. One's bottom set because they're not very good at English, and one's bottom set because they don't really care. And we'd like you to come in and work with those." And you think, oh, great. They sound lovely. Yeah. And I went in, and I take with me wherever I go my shed here. I live in rural Cornwall, and I have a shed that's full of sensory resources. So people who follow me online will be very familiar with pictures of me with plastic crates that are full up of things that smell a bit interesting or feel a bit interesting, or or the ones that smell a bit interesting. You always hope that those ones don't come open on the train, because then people will associate those smells with you. But yeah. I went into this secondary school with a box of things that, you know, feel a bit interesting and smell a bit interesting. And I challenged these students to condense the narrative that they were studying for English. And this is a long time ago now. So in my head, I think they were studying Moby Dick. But that sounds ever so advanced, doesn't it? It was some sort of aquatic narrative, because I remember the boat at the end of it. I said, "You've got to take this down into 10 sentences. And what they heard was, "We've got a supply teacher," because I wasn't their supply teacher. I was somebody they hadn't recognized before. So they view you as a supply teacher. "We've got a supply teacher, and she only wants us to write 10 sentences. This is going to be an easy lesson. And she's brought in toys for us to play with." And so they started quite enthusiastically, and they were messing around a lot. They were, you know, touching the things that felt funny and sniffing things. But then they got onto those conversations with their mates about, okay, well, if we're writing 10 sentences, which characters do we need? What has to happen? And you were into some quite complicated comprehension challenges when you try and condense a big text like that down to its essence. So yes, you can use them across settings, but their pride and joy is their ability to connect with people who don't use language as a communication tool. And when you get to share narrative in a sensory way, then you get to share a story with somebody who doesn't necessarily use words. And it's not just about being able to tell them that story. It's about being able to share in the story with them. Because you know from, like, telling stories to your own children, or, you know, to your grandchildren, or to, you know, or to grown-ups, you know, there is something about being in the narrative space with somebody that's really precious. And we can't always get into that space with somebody who doesn't use words. And sensory stories give you an in. So I am their biggest fan.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when I've used sensory stories and done a bit of research around them, it does really take you into that world where, you know, you can share that shared sensory experience with that individual who is not necessarily, you know, able to verbally tell you how they're feeling about that story. And I do think there's a good crossover between actually the benefits of sensory stories for special educational needs, but also towards the mainstream side of things, where they're getting a thing, think and feel a bit more with their senses, which would then definitely benefit their writing, wouldn't it? Lord Joanna, hello.
Am I still there?
You're still there, but it's just a little bit faint.
Oh, I wonder why.
There, you're back. You're back loud and clear. Yeah, back loud and clear.
I'll sit very still. I was just saying there's a benefit to mental health as well in connecting with your senses, and that's something that's very important as we come out of the pandemic for everybody.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think that we'll touch on the pandemic a little bit later on, but the sensory stories have kind of been impacted the most in terms of the pandemic, because when we've all been, you know, doing remote learning or virtual learning, that kind of shared sensory experience has been taken away almost. So almost sensory stories need to have a real big comeback at the start of next term for me, just to get those learners back into that wonderful experience of having that, you know, their senses almost being reawakened again, I suppose.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. And to use them as a route into coming back, because I've used sensory stories to support access to places. And one of the big shifts that your learners will be facing is that move back into the classroom and all those unfamiliar sensory experiences again.
Yeah, which is exactly true. And I think that could be a lovely way, as almost a bit of a recovery curriculum for them to come back and access the sensory stories a little bit more. Yeah. And then that helps with the whole process of it. Just going back, you give a really good succinct overview of the sensory stories. But what, in your personal experience when working with special educational learners, do you find that there's one particular set of SEND learners that benefit more from sensory stories, or is it just a great tool regardless of what need that you have?
I said a minute ago I'm their biggest fan, so it's very tempting just to say everybody, because yeah, they are wonderful. And sometimes I get attributed with being like an origin point for sensory stories, and I am not in any way. Sensory stories were something I bumped into in my teaching, and they had a sort of a Damascean effect on me. They were like, light from above, hallelujah, here's the answer. And I was teaching in a classroom that had very differently abled learners. I had some learners in my classroom who were achieving beyond their mainstream peers, but they weren't in a mainstream setting because of the social challenges they faced in that environment. And I had learners in my classroom who would have been described on a cognitive level as being, you know, akin to a baby in their understanding. And I was looking for something that could reach all of these learners, and sensory stories did that. But they do very different things for different groups. So my passion is for learners who have profound and multiple learning disabilities, and the use of sensory stories with that demographic can be really profound. But the other group that my heart leans towards when you think about sensory stories is people who experience sensory differences. So quite often that's our neurodiverse population and people who have those different ways of processing the senses or different reactions to sensory experience can really find support within a sensory narrative.
Yeah, we just while you're on that, Joanna, we've got a call in, so I'm hopefully going to let them join now if I can. It's not letting me, I don't know why, not sure. Not letting me join in for whatever reason, but we'll kind of come back to that if possible a little bit later on. Just with the sensory stories, from my point of view and my experiences when working with those learners who have profound multiple learning disabilities, that is the group I've particularly worked with the most, and that is most benefit. That's where I've seen the most benefit. But the neurodiverse population is becoming more and more akin to using sensory stories. So We do have a speaker joining us now, so I'll him on now. So, hello, our caller. Can you hear us?
I can see them live.
Yeah. Hello. live radio.
I'll Interrupt me if you can talk, caller.
Yeah.
I was just going to tell you, what you said then made me think about a project that I've been doing recently with Exeter University, where we're using sensory stories to support access to outdoor experiences. And this particular sensory story is for kayaking. And so we're using a sensory story for some people who can't go kayaking. They're having a kayaking type experience through the senses. But for other people, the sensory barriers to going kayaking are the things that might prevent them from going. And I live near the sea, so going and having the adventures that you can have around about where I live. And so it's for people. So, for example, you might have an autistic person who finds the feeling of walking across wet sand too difficult to process, or the smell of, you know, wet wetsuits. These sorts of things throw up sensory barriers to people. And by having that sensory story and being able to rehearse those sensations before they go, they can either get the hang of it and think, yeah, it's okay, I could walk across the wet sand, I know what that's like now. Or they can work out a strategy for how they're going to deal with that when they get there. So, for example, one guy I know is just going to keep his socks on. And that's not a big deal. But if the first time you realise that you're going to struggle to walk on the wet sand is on the day that you're there to go canoeing and go on this trip, then that experience of the wet sand blocks you. Whereas if you know it's upcoming, you can take your socks with you, you can keep your socks on, and you get to go kayaking. And so we're creating access through these sensory narratives as well.
Yeah, you can. It's almost some learners that I've had when I've done sensory stories, you almost find that when they're exposed to a new sense, or they are practicing in preparation for kind of an activity that's based around that sense, it can almost open up new worlds for them in terms of actually, yeah, this is not as bad as I first thought, or it's actually going kayaking or visiting the beach, the sand, or visiting the park and potentially walking on the grass, you know, is going to be okay, because I've had that practice, I've had these stories where I've experienced that sensation and that feeling in a positive and it's almost in a safe environment as well, because everyone else is joining in with that sensory experience, and we all have sensory preferences, you know. I don't particularly like the beach, I don't particularly like walking on the sand, but you know, if I was to do a sensory story around it, then I would kind of get used to that feeling and be able to tolerate it and be okay with it. So yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from with that.
Yeah, I've got a great sensory story that you get to squish wet sand between people's toes in that I like telling.
Oh, lovely. Not one for me, I don't think, but yeah, I can see how that would be a lovely story for all the people.
I think it's useful to think about the roots of these sensory differences, because our senses are partly about our sense organs, you know, the receptor part, you know, I've got eyes that work so I can take in visual information, but they're also partly about the processing of that information by the brain. And I think commonly people just think of them as the receptor organs, you know, like if your eyes work, then you can see, if your ears work, then you can hear. But it's only about 25% receptor organ. The rest of it is backstage in the brain making sense of that information. So I have a friend who's blind, her eyes work perfectly, but her brain doesn't understand the information that it gets from them. And for people who've got sensory differences, for some of those people, it's a sort of a practicing difference. If you think about the senses as having volume controls on them, in order to take in information, you want it to hit your brain at just the right volume. So like as people listen to us now, they will have set the volume on whatever gadget that they're listening to us on to a setting that suits their ears. And if it was too loud, yes, they'd be able to hear this information, but they'd be dealing with us shouting at them. And so that would take up their kind of energy and their ability to take on the information. And if it's too quiet and you're straining to hear it, it's the same thing. It's very difficult to get the information. So one of the skills involved in sensing is sort of tuning your brain in to the sensory experience. And for some people, they need more practice to do that tuning. So the repeated exposure that a sensory story would offer you, because you always want to tell sensory stories more than once, is the opportunity to practice tuning in. And so for like my guy who doesn't want to walk across the wet sand, multiple experiences of having the chance to tune in, how much do I want to tune in? You know, what volume do I want to set that at? Could mean that he could get to a point where he could tune that sense in and he would feel okay walking across wet sand. But other people have broken volume controls. And so no matter how much practice we give them, they would never get to a point where they could cope with the wet sand. And so what we would be doing for them is, you know, finding the socks, getting the wetsuit boots on, not expecting that sensory adjustment to be made. And I think it's really useful when we support people to recognize that there are those two groups. We might not know which group a person falls into, but just by being aware that those two groups are out there, we can be reflective in our practice and evaluate as things are going on, thinking, you know, do I think that they're adjusting to this sensation, or should I be putting in a way, teaching them a way of coping with this sensation? Because to just repeatedly expose somebody to sensation on the idea that they will somehow like magically get better is mean.
Exactly that. And I think that's a great point that you've touched upon there, with the sensory stories need to be repeated and those sensations need to be practiced over gradually over time. It's not a case of just exposing, you know, a learner to a particular sensation and then going and practicing to the beach, for example. And it's great to hear that actually, yeah, there is those two camps of learners who will gradually, you know, expose themselves to that sensation and have that ability to cope with it and tolerate it. But then there'll be other groups that actually can't. And through the sensory stories, I found that when accessing those different sensations, it can become quite, over time when you repeat the stories, it can become quite obvious which group those learners go into, because you'll find the ones that have that ability to cope and tolerate it will push themselves a little bit more in terms of, you know, they might, you know, put their foot in a particular sensation for a little bit longer period of time, whereas those learners that have put the foot in and immediately want to take it out and keep doing that, you know, story, repeated story after story, it can see those two definitive groups, which is great. So with the sensory stories, we're kind of going to move on to the next little bit of what we're going to chat on to, which was about, the actual senses themselves and the importance of, you know, being able to access those senses and have opportunities to almost practice being sensory beings, which is kind of very topical at the moment because of the past 18 months and the COVID-19 pandemic, which is when we've had a little meeting before coming on to do this show, we kind of discussed that actually because of the pandemic, a lot of opportunities have been lost for those learners. So can you give a sense to the listeners of the importance of the senses to a special educational needs learner who, you know, either is struggling to manage their sensations or is struggling to access particular sensations? Why is there so much importance for you on that?
Yeah. Gosh, that's like 10 questions rolled into
I know it is. I'm really, really sorry.
I'm keeping a list in my head. We've all just gone through the experience of lockdown, and that has taught people who might not otherwise have bumped into it a lesson in how important sensation is, because we know it's not good enough to just be able to see and hear a loved one. we want to be able to touch them and smell them as well. It's not the same on Skype and in Zoom. And actually, I think as we experience that deprivation, the reaction in us is to seek out sensation. So a lot of people became more connected to nature during lockdown, or more connected to craft activities. And these are things that are not necessarily intellectual pursuits. These are tactile, visceral, embodied pursuits. We are brains in bodies, and we need to feel both. And in an information-rich world, we can feed our brains loads. You can sit on your phone and you can pick up all sorts of information. You can Google for anything. You can watch the television and take in all this information. But you can get a disconnect with your body. And it's important to be in your body as well. And there's interesting research that looks into this, where they go into universities and they find people who are particularly brain-based, like they go into the physics department, into the basement of a university, and find these incredibly intelligent people who've completely disconnected from their bodies. And it's not good for us. We have to be both things. And for our sensory learners, for people who might not have access to cognition in the way that we do, the sensory world is all the more important. And actually, access to your senses and access to stimulation is part of keeping your brain healthy. So it's not either or. It's not cognition or sensation. Sensation supports cognition. And in the start of cognition, sensation is the building blocks. The sensory experiences that we access don't help the wiring of the brain. They are how the brain gets wired. And we know from research, the research that has been done in this field, a lot of it comes from the Romanian orphans. And I'm old enough to remember when the orphanages in Romania were opened in the 80s. And we met a generation of children who had grown up without access to a rich sensory diet, without access to, you know, to so many things. And although you would never put a population through that in order to study them, that population went through that means that they've been of enormous interest to the research community. And the follow-up studies done on the Romanian orphans 20 years after those orphanages were open show that there is a critical period in our development for access to stimulation. And if during this critical period we have access to a rich range of sensory input, then our brains wire themselves up and we become cognitively able adults. And if we don't have access, those things don't happen. And when we think about the people that we support in our special schools and in our care settings, although it might seem that they have a rich range of access, when you start considering their lives as a whole and comparing them to a mainstream learner or to your average person on the street, you suddenly appreciate where those gaps are. Just in that, you know, when we were in lockdown and you spent 2 weeks sitting inside your house, I'm sure your house has plenty of things to touch and to smell, but it's not anywhere near as many experiences as you were used to before. And so for some of the learners that I used to support, they would have very rich sensory environments at home. Their parents would, you know, have all sorts of amazing things in their house. And they would catch a bus and they would come to school and they would be in a room at school that was similarly littered with amazing resources. And then they would catch the bus back to that home environment and catch the bus back to school. And their experience of life was those two little pods, richly populated pods, but those two little places. I didn't bump into them in the supermarket because the supermarket hasn't got a changing places toilet. And I, you know, you don't encounter them in the wider world because there isn't ramp access, there isn't wheelchair access. You can't get across the beach unless they've got one of those, you know, amazing squishy wheeled dune buggy type wheelchairs. And so they have a limited access to stimulation. And it's so unfair, because it's all the more important to them and they're getting less of it. So it's why, like, people who do jobs like yours, you're so important, because you can go out into the world and collect that stimulation and bring it in for your learners to have that access.
Yeah.
Sorry, I stopped really suddenly then.
No, that's fine. It's okay. No, I, I agree with all your points there in terms of the importance of actually those SEND learners who aren't as cognitively able as you know the everyday person on the street. It is a massive importance. So I know through the pandemic that you kind of gathered some free resources and put things available to help that situation. But think about the pandemic as a snapshot. Has that highlighted possibly the need for ourselves as teachers to be more aware of actually getting those learners into different sensory environments, you know, out in the big wide world, instead of just keeping some of those learners in those richly populated sensory pods of home and school? Is that potentially a good thing that's come from the pandemic, that we can actually reflect and think, yes, we need to get that specific type of learner where it is massively important for those senses to access different environments? Personally, for me, I think it is, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think it is. I think your start point to that question, what's the pandemic highlighted for that population of learners, in my head goes to a different answer, because I, as well as doing my work on the sensory projects, all of my work is intended to contribute to a future where people are understood in spite of their differences. And I view myself as working on behalf of people with profound and multiple learning disabilities. So my focus is always them, even though some of the things that I do might touch on different populations, they're always my start point. And I'm one of the lead authors on the core and essential service standards for supporting people with profound and multiple learning disabilities, which isn't a sexy sounding title, but it's a very useful document.
It's
free to download from my website if people are curious. And when the pandemic started, what I saw is lots of families saying, you know, what about my loved one? And what about my, and them being forgotten. And when you talk about teachers wanting to do these things, yes, I see loads of individual teachers wanting to do these things. Do I see them supported by the senior management teams in their schools? Sometimes. Do I see training provided for them, you know, at a national level in a way that's accessible and relevant to their learners and to their cohorts? Sometimes, not very often. you're a very isolated population, and you run on an enormous amount of goodwill, but you're not supported the way that you should be supported, and the families are not supported in the way that they should be supported. And that was just bought into definition by the pandemic. It wasn't something I didn't know before. It was just something that was easier to ignore before.
Mm. Just reflecting back on last week's chat that we had with Stephen Unwin, he kind of touched on it again, that the pandemic has brought quite sharply into focus that SEND learners have kind of been left on the sidelines, really, and specific populations. He was talking about his son Joy, who had complex learning disabilities, and it, you know, again, that was. He felt that group was particularly segregated and left to kind of fend for themselves. And those with profound multiple learning disabilities, again, you're a great advocate for that. There's other people on Twitter who are also great advocates and speak on behalf of these families. But probably the pandemic has highlighted, although ourselves as teachers are try our very, very best to help where we can, those that teacher and activities and planning and resources around, you know, sensory activities, whether that be sensory stories, visiting different environments within the community, that wasn't able to be replicated as easily as, say, a mainstream learner in a secondary school that can just go on to, you know, Microsoft or Google Classroom and can access a live lesson. Those with profound multiple learning disabilities can't do that. It was kind of left up to the parents, really, a lot of the parents or carers, a lot of the time, to to work with the teacher and almost make do. It sounds, for me as a teacher, it sounds horrible to say that, but that's kind of what it was, because you can't replicate those same environments, those same activities at home. It's really hard, I think. And I think that the pandemic has brought that into major focus, but it's now about how we go forward with that. So
I can do cheerful stuff as well, because it's very depressing when you think all the things that are set against this population. But there have been some amazing initiatives during lockdown. Frozen Light, the sensory theatre company Frozen Light, ran a podcast connecting with their audience, and their audience is an audience with profound and multiple learning disabilities. And that's full of insight that's relevant to people. And they sent out a theatre production in a cardboard box, as did Oily Cart and some of the other theatre companies. Concrete Youth, I'm just thinking of all these amazing sensory theatre companies that are out there. And so people were able to make those connections. There's an amazingly supportive group on Facebook called Supporting PMLD Teaching and Learning. And as lockdown started, I saw that group come alive with teachers saying, how are you going to do this? And working out how to create a sensory lesson that they could present on Zoom or present sort of through MS Teams and that parents could take part in at home. And then the flip of that is the at-home experience. I saw lots of very, very frightened families, families that had to give up having their carers come in to support them because they needed to protect their incredibly vulnerable loved ones. And that experience for families was isolating and brutal and knackering and terrifying, and just to run on adrenaline for that long, it is awful. But within those families, those loved ones who were protected, I've seen some gorgeous stories there. I'm thinking of one little girl who I watched start talking through lockdown. And she started talking because she was at home all the time, and all the people that she loved were at home all the time, and everybody understood her pre-existing communications, and everybody responded to her all the time. And she had words emerge for the first time. Yes, all those people in that house were knackered and stressed and wrecked, but for her, she was right where she would want to be. And another young man that I know who has profound and multiple learning disabilities, he had the opportunity to spend time connecting with sensations at a pace that suits him. And so had he been in my classroom every 45 minutes, we'd have probably started a new activity, because I've had those slots on the school timetable that said it's break time now, it's dinner time now, you've got to do this, or it's time for us to go here, you're forever lining children up or collecting coats or working out where you've left the medications. It's go, go, go. And at home, he could do an activity for 3 hours, and it might just be that activity was touching some dried leaves on a tray, but how much he got out of that was just spectacular to see. So there were these points of light amidst all the grotty darkness.
So that, just really interesting, that point that you're making about the little girl who was in the environment. and being able to talk, and the other learner, the young man who was able to go at his own pace. So has that made you reflect now as a teacher to think, I know the school environment is go, 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 and there's specific slots for, break times or lunch times, home times, that type of thing. But has that made you reflect and think, well, actually, should I be, sticking to a time for this particular activity, or do I let that learner have a bit more of a personalized thing where he goes and does an activity for and kind of he navigates his own way, really? I think that's what I'm trying to say. Has that made you think about how you deliver to those learners?
I think teachers are often having to strike a balance, or they're walking between that tension of what they know is best for those students and the demands of the structure around them. So when I was a teacher, those demands were that I had a geography lesson at this point in the day and a history lesson at this point in the day and a science lesson at this point in the day. And should anybody walk in, I should be able to justify why this was science or why this was history. And to be honest, those lessons were all very similar. I just dressed them up in different ways because at the heart of those lessons was always what my students needed. And that might be the same thing in both lessons. And so I might be doing the same thing in both lessons, just at one point it's called history and another point it's called geography. That was the tension that I operated within. People who are teaching today will have different sort of policy and procedure pressures on them. But they're still playing the old game of dressing up, doing the right thing by their students in the language and the decoration required by those policies and procedures. I hope that we are seeing an evolution in those policies and procedures that means that that dress up that you have to do is narrowing and that it's sort of tuning in. It often depends on the leadership in a setting and how much they understand the populations that they're supporting. And sadly, I'm a big research geek, as people who follow me on Twitter will know. So the research shows that most people who support people with profound and multiple learning disabilities do so under a management, be that a management in a care setting or a management in a school setting, that has less knowledge of that population than they do. Mm. And so you will get whole school policies or whole setting policies, everybody must. And any time you hear an everybody must or all children will, you've just heard somebody not speaking in an inclusive way, because it sounds really inclusive. Everybody, all, yeah, but they're all different. And when you say everybody will do the same thing, you're not recognizing that difference. And we are truly inclusive when we include everybody as they are. And so in some settings, you will have those policies and that will be a block to people. And in other settings, you'll have a bit more bend and flow. I'm just watching the engagement scales come out now and wondering how that's going to go in settings across the country.
Yeah. So I've seen that as well. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see how different people, how different leadership interpret that and how it's applied, really. But yeah, I'm a big believer in that actually. Yeah, we still have, leadership teams and almost sometimes school, policies or philosophies on those type of learners, and they will or they must do those things. And yeah, hopefully from this, bad thing of the pandemic, that actually we can shift away and actually, make it a lot more tailored and a lot more specific to those learners, and not have to dress things up around a particular, curriculum offer that the leadership team is going with. So that's been brilliant. The kind of the first half that we've discussed together. So if it's okay with you, Joanna, we'll go to a quick news, couple of adverts, and then in the second half we're going to look at sensory needs and behaviours and. The different types of needs that some learners might have and how those behaviours are displayed, both positive and negative, and then links to the senses and our mental health. So that's coming up in the second half of the show. So we'll go across to some news now.
Super.
This is Teachers Talk Radio News. This is Julie, Teacher's Talk Radio News with Gil Clay. Dr. Mike Gilfley, member of the Scientific and Pandemic Influenza Modelling Group, has put an unexpected pause in cases of COVID-19 down to schools closing for the summer holidays. Confirmed infections have fallen for 5 days in a row, for the first time since early February. But Dr. Tilsley warned that it's possible that cases may seem to go down,
when infections may not be going down as fast due to a drop often in the testing of pupils. Various theories explaining the fall have been suggested by scientists, including good weather encouraging outdoor socialising, the Euros finishing, and increased immunity via vaccines and infections. Experts have also stated that the effects of the July the 19th relaxation of social distancing guidelines will not become evident for several days. A number of secondary schools in the borough of Trafford have received funding to support summer schools that aim to mitigate the impact on education of the COVID pandemic. The Department for Education website states anecdotal evidence also points to children and young people's health having suffered from lockdown and from periods of individual or class isolation, even after schools reopened fully in the autumn term. It estimates that pupils attending a summer school can make 2 months additional progress compared with pupils who don't attend, and up to 4 months additional progress if the summer school offers small group tuition led by highly trained and experienced teaching staff. Each individual school needs to apply for its own funding and are individually responsible for their summer learning plans. This has been your daily education news briefing.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, ESHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique challenging escape routes themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, party puzzles and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website www.creativeresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative resources made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when a box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. Introducing the Leadership Masterclass Series by Diana Osagie. Learn how to ditch your fears and develop your leadership confidence. How to deal with difficult colleagues. How to thrive when you lead in a challenging environment. How to get colleagues to buy into your vision. Join Diana for her online leadership masterclasses starting on 10th of July and running all the way through the summer. These sessions are the perfect way to prepare and refresh for the next academic year and beyond. Book your place at creativeleadership.com/events now. The first 50 leaders to sign up get an additional free mini coaching session with Diana herself. Don't miss this. Courageous Leadership Masterclasses at CourageousLeadership.com.
fbtc.co.uk/events. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter code TTRadio when you buy your first stationery box and save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club.
And welcome back to the Drive Home Show with me, Neil Mullen. So if you missed the first half, we were discussing all things sensory. So we discussed sensory stories and the sensors themselves and their importance on those learners who need access the most. And we touched a little bit on the pandemic. So this second half, we are going to look at sensory needs and the behaviours that's associated with those needs, and then kind of how our senses and accessing those can have links to mental health as well. So, Joanna, it's nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And so in this first little bit of the second half, we're going to talk about sensory needs. So can you give the listeners a little bit of an overview of what the term sensory needs means?
I think we touched on it in the first half, didn't we, Neil? Because it's that idea that everybody has differences in how they process sensory information, and we all like to be in a situation in which our senses have the things that they need or don't have the things that stress them out. And for most people, the day-to-day world will be at a sensory level that's more or less appropriate to them. Something could be a bit loud or something could be a bit bright or a bit itchy, but for in the main, the day-to-day environment will suit most people. But for other people, the day-to-day environment will provide too much or too little sensation. And then it depends how you layer it, because then it gets more complicated, because it will do that at certain times of day, or it'll do that depending on how you feel, or it will do that across one sensory system but not another sensory system, or you'll have a sensory system that needs more input and then needs less input. So it gets very complicated very quickly. But just that idea that you're measuring things against the day-to-day experience of daily life, and for some people those experiences are too much or they are not enough. And then as people react to that, you see different behaviours that tell you about those sensory needs and differences.
Yeah, so if we kind of just focus in on, obviously, the thing that you go back to is profound multiple learning disabilities. Yeah. So if we just touch on that group for and talk through the sensory needs of that particular learner group, what kind of sensory needs would that type of learner typically display?
That's an interesting one, actually, because they might not be as able to display those needs as somebody else in their peer group, for example. So I'm thinking back to my old class where I had learners who had profound and multiple learning disabilities, but I also had neurodiverse learners who had sensory differences. And a neurodiverse learner who is struggling with the noise that's being emitted by the overhead electric lighting might be able to communicate that very clearly through squealing or through covering their ears, through curling in a ball, through doing some quite big obvious physical things. You will see people in sensory distress lash out. You know, it's not a subtle thing. You know, mm-hmm. You can see some quite big behaviours come from this. Whereas a learner who's got a physical disability might be feeling those same things, but not able to display them as clearly. So you might not necessarily see the sensory needs and differences of learners with profound and multiple learning disabilities, but being aware that they can be there can help you tune into how they're feeling. And you sort of, I was going to say, you sense them yourself, and that sounds like a throwaway comment, but actually, you literally do.
Because you
use one of your subconscious senses to do that tuning in. So you can feel it in a way.
I completely understand where you come from. It's almost, if you're working with that learner on a day-to-day basis, so you can kind of see and almost... one of those subconscious senses that actually that's a sensory need that they're displaying, and this is what I think they need or they're struggling with, things like that. So in terms of our neurodiverse population, those behaviours are quite easily displayed when they're in distress over their senses. So In various schools that I've worked in, and various learners that I've worked with, those learners have had sensory diets within that particular school. Again, lots of schools use the term sensory diet, but I want to kind of get your views on that.
We said easily displayed. I wouldn't say that for the whole of that population. There's a model of sensory processing disorder that's a nice, clear, broad brush version of it, which is Dunn's model, and that measures your sensory processing against the sort of day-to-day. So somebody will have a high threshold or a low threshold. So if you've got a high threshold to sensory experience, then the everyday world might be not enough for you. And if you've got a low threshold, then the everyday world is too much for you. And then you have either an active or a passive behavior response to that. So if you imagine it like a little grid of four boxes stacked up together, so you have high and low threshold on one side, and then you have active and passive along the top. If you've got a high threshold to sensory experience, such that the day-to-day world is not really enough for you, and an active response to that, you're going to do something to get more stimulation. So you're going to, push the things to see if they make a noise. You're going to make a noise yourself. You're going to move around. You're going to be active, and I'm going to notice you because you're doing something. But you could have somebody who has a high threshold and a passive behavior strategy. They're going to feel that need for more stimulation, but they're not necessarily going to actively do something. Those people are much harder to spot. And the same goes for the other way around. If you've got a low threshold and the everyday world is too much for you, then you might actively do something to shut it out. So you might put your fingers in your ears. You might hum really loudly to block out sound. You might bash your head on something. You might physically sort of curl up and hide yourself away from life. And likewise, you could have a passive responder who feels all of that discomfort but isn't doing those things. And those passive responders have as much need of our support as the active responders, but they're so much harder to spot. You mentioned sensory diets. It's good that we're on radio, isn't it? Because nobody could see my eyes roll.
No, I could sense through the waves
I
just wanted to get your thoughts on it, because I've been in schools where they've been in learners, EHCP plans, and being in learner packs when you're going in. But I wanted to get your thoughts before discussing it further.
It's much the same as sensory rooms. There is some amazingly good practice, and there's a lot of just totally missing the point. One of the books that I wrote recently was to do with multisensory rooms. And what I did was I looked into the history of the rooms, and I read all the research I could lay my hands on about the rooms. And I interviewed loads of people who use the rooms, and I asked them about their experience. And overwhelmingly what they said was, we don't think we're doing it right.
I don't feel like I'm getting out of this space what I should be getting out of. And I bet you if I interviewed people about sensory diets, I'd get the same sort of like, well, it's good, but I don't think we've really, it's not quite, you know, it's not doing what we feel it's meant to. There's this gap between the expectation and the experience. And I explored why that was with sensory rooms. I haven't done it with sensory diets. I don't particularly fancy it. But what was missing was what's happened with sensory rooms is since their inception, we've seen an evolution of tech, not an evolution of practice.
Yeah.
We've seen them sold for higher and higher prices. We haven't seen more and more input put into how we use them. If you ask people, have you had training on how to use your sensory room? Everybody has had training on how to switch it on and off. And out of everybody I interviewed, only one person had had training in how to actually use it. Because the assumption is, well, you'll know how to use it.
Yeah.
You know, of course, it's a bizarre place. It's a dark space with fiber optics, or it's a place where you can project on all four walls. Why would you know what to do with that unless you've had it explored, unless you've thought about it with somebody, unless somebody's taught you how to do it? Just teaching you how to press all the switches doesn't do anything. But these things are sold, and I underline the word sold, because I had some fantastic sensory companies talk to me. And some people talk very candidly. I remember one guy saying, yeah, we buy it in from China. We add the word sensory and we sell it for three times the price. These things are sold. And sensory toys are currently being sold. They're being sold to a mass market now. In my local shop has just got those, you know, like the plastic version of bubble wrap where you can pop the things in and out.
Yeah,
and I went past and I thought, oh, yeah, that looks like that would be fun at a sensory level. I'll pick one. I went, £7? I'm not paying £7 for a pretend piece of bubble wrap. That's not, that's just profiteering. There's no understanding. These things need to be used with understanding in the same way that resources in any other field need to be used with understanding.
Mm.
Like if you wanted to teach students maths, and I always default back to maths because I studied maths and further maths at college, so I'm overly ingrained in the maths world. If I want to teach students maths, I don't just dish out maths resources. If I do, they'll play with them. They might learn a bit of maths from them, but I'll show them how to use them. And our sensory resources are the same. So to take a really simple one, you know, the settle jars, you like the snow globes where you've got lots of twinkly particles in a jar and it settles. Yeah. They're sold as sensory toys. It's sensory. You look at them and go, yeah, they're pretty. They're visually appealing. That's sensory. And you see them in catalogs, good for calming. And if you buy one of those things and you shake it and you give it to a child who's a bit stressed, the first time you hand it over, they'll look at it and go, ooh, this is pretty. They'll watch the particles settle and you'll look at them and think, oh, yeah, they calm down. It works. Job done. The next time they pick it up, it's not going to have that response because they've seen it before. There is a way of using those things to support children to calm, but it's not just handing them over. You can do, we were hinting around one of our subconscious senses just a little while ago. On the sensory projects, I run to 7 sensory systems. But once you start on the subconscious senses, it's a bit like a gateway drug, and it's very tempting to go into more and more of them. If you want to get technical about it, you have 33 sets of neurons that control your senses. So arguably you've got 33 sensory systems, but really it's like grouping stars in the sky into constellations. It depends how you organize them. But one of the sensory systems that's gained a lot of interest in recent years, and rightly so, is your interoceptive sense, which is it's your only sensory system that works inwards. All the others are outwards looking at the world, and your interception is inwards looking at your feelings and your internal landscape. And so when you ask somebody, how do you feel? And they say, I feel happy, or I feel excited. They feel like they're just reporting that feeling, that they are feeling happy and they say happy. But actually what they're doing is they're doing a quick internal audit. Their interception is scanning their body and going, oh, you know, there's no tension in my shoulders. There are no butterflies in my stomach. The muscles around my mouth are feeling tight on the upper side. I am happy. And they're reporting that back to you. And I need two words. I need two words for feeling, because your interception is your sense that feels your feelings. And you can have your feelings, but not have the interceptive skill of being able to read them. And then that leaves you in a very unusual position in life. One best articulated by a young man I heard of, who said the brilliant phrase, he said, "I knew I was angry because I hit him." Not, "I felt angry and then I hit him." Yeah. "I watched myself hit him, and from that I worked out that I must have been feeling angry." His anger was there all the time, but because he didn't have the interceptive ability, and your sense, your subconscious senses can be impaired just in the same way as your conscious senses can be impaired, and you can have processing differences with your subconscious senses too. If you can't feel your feelings, you can't make the adaptive adjustments in the world in response to them. So if, when I'm always with a particular person, they make me feel stressed and tense and uncomfortable, if I feel that after the first 5 minutes of spending time with them, I'll move away from them. But if I don't, I'll stay there until I'm so stressed and tense and uncomfortable that I feel it, you know, till it's rendered so bold. And by the time it's rendered that bold, you can't do anything about it. And it's a very common narrative for families and people who support neurodivergent people in particular, but other people who have sensory differences, is to say they were fine and then they just snapped. You know, there was no build up to this. They were fine, fine, and then they just went.
Yeah.
And seems really irrational, but this is the sort of the backstage of what's happening.
Yeah.
So you haven't got that awareness. And using a little thing like a settle jar, you can support somebody to develop that awareness. But it's not just a case of putting it down in front of them. You use it as an external marker for their internal landscape. So when you look at them and you see that they're all agitated, you shake the jar and you tell them, "I can see that you're feeling like this inside." And you're just, you could use anything as an external mark. You could have little, you know, the smiley faces and things like that. The smiley faces are a bit confusing because I think it's very easy for people to think that their face would turn green when they're happy and red when they're angry, because they quite often grade along a scale.
Yeah.
But, you know, depending on how you're doing it, you agitate the jar and go, "I can see that you're agitated because you're moving around a lot, because you're vocalizing a lot, because you're, you know, because your shoulders are up around your ears. You need to calm down, and I'm going to help you to calm down, and I would have a process for doing that." And I like the particles settling down as well, because as an autistic person, that direction within the instruction to calm is always one that I found a bit out of place. Like, why is calm down? Why isn't it up? Or left or right? Yeah. But the particles fall down. So if you were saying it to me, I'd be like, "Okay, so we're calming down. That's great." And then you get to calm and you label calm. And there's, you know, I can, this is too long to fit into your podcast, but there's a whole load of stuff to unpack there, which then makes that simple resource of some glitter in some water with a tablespoon of glycerin, or with a bit of clear glue if you want to make your own, a really, really powerful tool. And each of our little sensory tools could be that powerful. But what you need to make them powerful is the knowledge and understanding behind them. And that doesn't come to you in the catalogue. I talked to one company. I said, "Oh, you've labelled this up as good for autistic people. Why have you labelled this particular resource as good for autistic people?" And the guy said to me, he said, "Oh, it's mostly bought by families of autistic people." It's like, well, isn't that because you've got the label? Well, how does that work? How did you decide it?
Yeah, so which kind of goes, kind of sums up quite neatly the needs and the behaviours. So, you know, we were talking about that internal sensation being potentially impaired. That, you know, the young man said, "Oh, I knew I was angry because I hit him." So sometimes the behaviours can actually inform, you know, where that need is coming from. The need is, the sensory need is, I'm feeling angry. The behavior is, I've hit him, and that's how I recognize it. And I think you're right in terms of getting your thoughts on sensory diet. I think,
oh, they could be wonderful. They could be wonderful. Yeah. Just like sensory rooms could be wonderful. Yeah. I don't want to be sounding like I'm dissing these things.
I think you need the support. Right. Yeah, I think you're right in terms of how it's applied, and B, how it's then used. Because for me, when, you know, I've been in some schools, sometimes the sensory room is just seen as, you know, a place to take some learners and to have a little bit of, as some people may have put it, some sensory time, which actually, you know, what does that actually mean for the learner? What does it mean for you as that staff member going to the sensory
time? One of the listeners was just saying about them being timetabled, that you have timetabled sensory time. Yeah. Like, this is when you get 20 minutes a day when your sensory needs will be met, and for the rest of the day, good luck to you.
And it's your sensory needs will be met on a Tuesday at 10 o'clock each week.
So long as no one else is using
that. And it won't change. It'll be Tuesday at 10 o'clock each week. which is where the whole dynamic of the school pressures, but also the the professional pressures, because we want that sensory room to almost be quite fluid in terms of when that particular learner needs that sensory room and it's there for the purpose that we need it for, it should be there. But actually, the practicalities of it is we've got a whole school full of learners that may want to access that sensory room. I see how it's difficult, but actually we maybe need to think about actually, you know, the purpose of the sensory room and the purpose of the sensory diet, because in some schools I've worked in, the sensory diet is an activity that they go and do, or they're doing sensory diet activities. I can see why you've done that, but actually the sensory diet should be used in a way that benefits a learner, not just as a timetable activity for that learner. Yeah. So it's the good and bad. I think it's exactly what you said. Sometimes it can be really good. Sometimes it can't. It's not, I suppose.
I think it's worth recognizing that there's no malice there, is there? A school that has timetabled a sensory diet has gone, this is important to us. We value the sensory needs of our students. We will officiate it and put it on the timetable. That's a great starting point. It's not, they're not willfully doing something slightly, you know, less than desirable. They're trying really hard. They just haven't had the access to that information. And when I did my research into sensory rooms, I identified 12 key features of effective multisensory room practice. And some of these were barriers to effective practice, and some of these were things that supported effective practice. And honestly, when I set out on that research, I expected to find the sort of, you know, the top 10 bits of kit that you need in a sensory room. I thought that the equipment would feature somewhere in it, because I'm always asked by people, what should I have in my sensory room? And you're like, whatever you like. And only one thing on the list of 12 things that came up as significant was in any way to do with the equipment in the room. And one of the main barriers to access to sensory rooms was the timetabling of the rooms. And it's that simple, because a lot of places just have them timetabled, you know, 1 hour for everybody, because that's fair. And one of my interviewees on the research said something so clear and so poignant. She said, for the students in my class, the half an hour a week that they get in the sensory room is their only access to education. Within my classroom, I do the best I can, but I can't provide the environment that they need in the way that I can in the sensory room. And for the other students in this school who access the sensory room, that an hour that they get, because the other students got an hour because it wasn't as faffy for them to get to the room as it was for her students. For her students, getting to the room and all of that soaked up half of their hours allotments. She said, for those students, they have access to a learning environment that they can access for the whole of the school week. And it doesn't feel fair to me. And the timetabling of sensory rooms within group situations shouldn't be easy. It should be a really it should be one of those staff meetings that drags on and like, we'll come back to it next week, because it's a difficult thing to do. And it's not just a case of, you know, putting up a sign-up sheet on the door if you want effective practice.
Yeah, we have had a text in from one of our listeners saying there must be a way of turning classrooms into sensory rooms fairly cheaply. So in my personal experience, a fellow teacher of mine in a school I was in turned they almost had like a walk-in, a big walk-in cupboard that was just being used to store old resources, and she kind of stripped it out of all the shelves and just used, you know, really fairly accessible things. So fairly accessible lights from Amazon, different sensory objects that were either happened to be in the school or speaking with the staff members could think about which ones they could try and get access to. Yes, that was done fairly cheaply. I think the issue that I would see is whether or not the management would be keen for, you know,
why has Class 6 got all their students in
for 12 to 15 classrooms in a full school to start suddenly turning a space in their classroom into a sensory room? But it's doable though, isn't it? That's the main thing.
Totally. And there is no difference in how effective the sensory rooms that cost £2 million are compared to the sensory rooms that cost 20 quid. You can have just as ineffective. I went to a room that was 1.2 million and it is just as much potential to be ineffective as a sensory room that's made in a cupboard. Some of the first sensory rooms in the UK were exactly that, cupboard rooms off the corner classrooms. And you can get some brilliant blackout tents. I've got a blackout tent from, I think it's from TTS, that pops up, you know, like the way all tents do. And that creates a great little sensory environment. It cuts out the visual stimulation. Obviously, it's not cutting out the sound stimulation that you would get from outside. So you're thinking about those different things. And I've seen teachers do brilliant improvised blackout on whole rooms using Velcro dots and cardboard, because everybody's got Velcro dots, haven't they?
Yeah.
You put a Velcro dot on the corners of the window frames and then you cut a piece of cardboard that exactly fits that and you put the matching Velcro dots on that and you just pop the cardboard up and you can get blackout in the classroom. And that creates a wonderful landscape for sort of visually accessing.
Yeah, even things like tin foil you can put on windows, just in the windows, and that creates a really good effective blackout. I'm just thinking for one of the schools that I worked in previously, Hadrian School in Newcastle, they converted their whole sports hall and did like almost a sensory circuit where they had trampolines up for rebound therapy, but they put lights underneath the trampoline. They had lots of different sensory experiences, and the learners could just pretty much go in there and they dictated where they wanted to go and could move around different activities and spend the time they wanted on a particular activity, and it almost became like one giant sensory room.
The different
classes access, so that's kind of a different way to do things, where they were you know, the different classes could come at different times and different staff from different groups could speak to each other and they could all learn from different learners how they were accessing different things. So that's a different way
like so much fun. If you check out my Facebook page, I've got a photo album of improvised sensory rooms and there are some amazing ones. There's a special school, I think they're in Wales. They built their sensory room out of milk bottles, you know, the plastic 4-litre milk bottles. They made like a giant igloo sensory room out of them. And there's a sensory room that has a cow that you can milk in it in another one. There's all sorts of weird wonderful creations that people have made. So improvised spaces are absolutely as effective, if not more so, because they're often built around the needs of the people and the interests of the people who are going to be using them, whereas a installed, you know, ready-made sensory room is a very fixed thing. And it's difficult to animate that space and change it according to different needs. Yes, you can switch the different resources on and off, but you haven't got as much freedom as if you're, you know, building a different sensory environment in a tent each week.
Yeah. Again, we've had another text in saying they're going to try a blank wall approach in their class so they can project onto the walls and kind of...
That's wonderful.
And curtains for the windows just to create their own sensory room, which is fab. So I'm just a bit conscious that we're rapidly running out of time.
I know
you did, but it's been fab, don't worry. I've loved it. It's kind of just rounding everything up and it kind of links into the pandemic as well with how important the senses are to learners' mental health, really.
Mm. a connection with the sensory world is good for everyone's mental well-being, regardless of ability, disability, neurodiversity, neurodivergence. I think it's really interesting, your caller who said they're going to try a blank wall approach, because much of our day-to-day environment is assumed from a model that we've inherited. So our classrooms, if you imagine a primary school classroom, you have a pretty, you imagine brightly coloured pictures on the walls and an interactive display and an interactive whiteboard, and the plastic chairs will be in bold primary colours. Likewise, if you imagine somebody's living room, you're going to imagine a sofa with scatter cushions and a picture on the wall and a television. And we presume these spaces should look like this. And we presume that being in these spaces, if we struggle to be in those spaces, that that's something wrong with us. And actually, the way our primary school classrooms are set up is out of date with how we teach. Because originally, way back when we were first let out of like the workhouses in the fields and invited into school, we were sat in big church halls with tiny little windows right at the top and a teacher right at the front with a blackboard. And we all had to sit still and face forward and pay attention. And we couldn't, because it was tedious and they didn't know how to teach us in an entertaining way. And so we drifted and we daydreamed and we stared at the walls. And so they thought, okay, well, we'll stick the timetables on the walls. So at least when they're not looking at the teacher, they're still learning something. And stuff went up on classroom walls as a protection against boring teachers. And we are so much better at teaching. We have seen an evolution in practice in the way we teach. Most teachers are very engaging of their students and they don't drone on forever like I do. They do little bits and then they have interactive stuff. And all that, you know, if you wanted to create an environment for concentration at a sensory level, you probably couldn't design one worse than your average primary school classroom. And certainly if you want to create an environment that's comfortable for somebody who struggles with sensory processing, you couldn't create one worse than your average primary school classroom. So the idea of having a blank wall so that you can present against something and the attention is given to the stimulation that you want, not used up by the stimulation all around, is wonderful. And for everybody, taking a pause and reflecting on their sensory environment and asking, is it the one that's right for me, or is it just the one that it's presumed I will live in, can be a lovely way of attending to your own mental health. And then obviously if you do that, you are such a linchpin for the students that you teach, that will have a knock-on effect in your classroom.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there in terms of actually it's about creating the right environment for those sensory needs, in terms of giving the learners the sensory feedback that they require, but also slowly chipping away at those environments. Because actually in most primary schools, you spot on with primary schools are very colourful. But just thinking, I've just reflected while you were talking there of the special schools I've worked in, that everything was quite visual along corridors in terms of brightly coloured displays and
chairs.
Yeah, and in some cases there was a music display, so they had musical instruments that you could pick up and think, well, actually for a learner who struggles with, you know, a neurodiverse learner that struggles with that noise, that could be you know, a negative impact on their mental health in terms of a transition from the classroom to the lunch hall or to the bathroom or you know, that could be a negative impact. But then just touching back on our message that we got about the blank wall approach, that is almost stripping it back to real basic sensory level, where you're going to actually get a learner engaging and feeling really, 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 really calm in that environment. And it's a blank canvas for those staff to really create the right environment. And it would be interesting to see how many schools up and down the country would be almost brave enough to just
well, there's some nice little there are some nice little workarounds you can do. If you've got a caretaker or a handy person who'll put you up a curtain rail, you can just have some curtains that will pull across over your displays, or a roller blind that will drop down over them. And the nice thing about curtains especially is that that can buffer some of the sound as well, so you don't necessarily have that, you know, tinny sound quality that you get in some classrooms. So there are sort of botch solutions to these things.
No, there is. I'm just thinking of a couple of schools I've worked in where they've had they've dedicated one corridor within the school where everything is there's no displays, and it's pretty, you know, neutral colouring or white, you know, background, and learners who are feeling particularly, you know, displaying those behaviours of, you know, in distress with their sensory feedback, they've been able to go to that specific place and kind of almost, you know, I don't want to use the word calm down because that's, you know, but, you know, regulate themselves back to calmness, I suppose. So it's, yeah, those other little hints and tips are great things. Just a kind of sum that part up before we do a major sum up of it is actually thinking about our senses is not only for our learners, you know, trying to interpretate their senses and how that's affecting their mental health. I think as for us as practitioners, we need to kind of think about, you know, our own practice in terms of our own senses and how we are engaging with learners and how that is affecting them. Because actually, you know, what my teaching practice might actually be not very good for their mental health. It might be actually, you know, not the best thing for them. So I think that's something that needs to be almost shared as well.
Yeah, and your classroom environment needs to be right for you too, because if your classroom is somewhere that you're coping with being in, then you'll have less patience, you'll have less energy to dedicate to those learners. Most people wouldn't want to be in a primary school classroom with a headache, for example.
Yeah.
It's just too bright. Yeah.
That's exactly it. It's finding what works for that particular group of learners within that classroom and making that classroom environment, you know, a good sensory space, whether that be, you know, creating your own little sensory room within that, you know, not having as many colourful displays, trying reducing sound feedback, things like that. And from the couple of texts that we've got in, it's all about knowing that particular learner that you're working with. And I think in terms of all the things that we've taught about, many different and wide ranging topics, I think it always comes back to, you know, working with that particular learner who does have sensory difficulties or difficulty, you know, displaying those sensory needs. It's kind of working with that learner and getting a real close connection with them, I think.
Yeah,
it is. So on behalf of me, Joanna, it's been fab to have you on today.
Thanks
very
much.
A couple of people have texted in saying your excellent insights into this. What I'll do for everyone is I'll share Joanna's website, The Sensory Projects. I know she shared a link on the live live stream, but I'll tweet that out as well, and I'll share the link because it's a fab resource.
You mentioned earlier, Neil, that there's some free resources there that I compiled during the lockdown. Some of them are a bit out of date now because they were for the lockdown, but there's lots of free stuff on the website. And I run online training, which is all about the knowledge and understanding that I've been jabbering on about. But I've recently put up a free one of them as well that's looking at autism from a mainstream perspective. And do come and find me on social media because there's all sorts of stuff on my profiles. And I'm always happy to chat about this stuff, as you can probably hear from me jabbering at you today.
No, it's been fab. I've genuinely loved chatting to you. I could chat a long while longer, but unfortunately my show's only
time's up,
you know, 90 minutes long. So it's been fab to have you. Please do go and follow Joanna on Twitter. She's always available to chat and connect with people. I'll share the link with for the sensory project again, if you have anything else that you'd like to text or tweet in, please do on the Teacher Talk Radio Twitter page or my own Twitter handle. Again, just a massive thank you to you, Joanna, for giving up your time to chat with me.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Next week, we're going to look at a different topic. Haven't quite decided what that will be, but I'll post something out towards the end of this week. In the meantime, have a lovely rest of the week. And I will see you next week. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the evening. Bye.